On December 9th of 1909, Eliza Gribble and her daughter Carrie Olander were discovered dead inside their home in Savannah, Georgia. Just inside the door of their home was their tenant, Maggie Hunter, who was found clinging to life. All of the women had been attacked with an axe. The crime remains one of the most diabolical in the history of Savannah, Georgia. Who was the murderer and what was the motive? This is the story of the Gribble House murders of Savannah. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight. And I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Wherever you live, there's a part of town that you may avoid after dark, unless you're looking to get into trouble. In Savannah, Georgia, in 1909, that area of the city was a neighborhood known as Frogtown. People around the city knew this as a place you'd find thieves, addicts, tramps, a cheap place to live, and if you went looking for it, you'd be able to find a woman on the cheap as well. A large part of Frogtown was inhabited by people who just didn't have the best reputation. But there were also people who were struggling, and this was the only place they could afford to live. 401 West Perry Street was a home situated near the railroad tracks in Frogtown. It was known as the Gribble House, a boarding house that was the home of three women. 70-year-old Eliza Gribble, her 36-year-old daughter Carrie Olander, and 34-year-old tenant Maggie Hunter. Eliza Gribble had been born in Cornwall, England, and came to America as a young woman. She was a widow who decided to open the boarding house on Perry Street to care for herself and her daughter. There were few options for women to make money at this time in history, and Eliza saw taking in boarders as a respectable way of making income. Eliza was doing the best she could and was thankful when her daughter Carrie moved back to Savannah to help her with the business. Carrie had been living in Memphis but divorced her husband and needed a fresh start. Carrie was partially deaf. It said that she could hear very loud sounds but little else. The third woman in the home, Maggie Hunter, was a source of gossip around town. She had just separated from her third husband, J.C. Hunter, who was 30 years older than Maggie. J.C. Hunter's real name was David Taylor. Following his days as a Confederate soldier, he had turned to a life of crime, including stealing horses and bigamy. After his second stay in jail, he changed his name to Hunter. But anyone who knew David Taylor couldn't be tricked by his name change. He stood out to many because he was missing an eye and walked with a cane. Maggie Hunter knew of her husband's secrets, and that's why she knew she had to move on and had moved into Gribble House to start rebuilding her own life. She came with few possessions, save a sewing machine that she planned to use to make her living as a dressmaker and seamstress. On the afternoon of December 9th of 1909, just before 3 p.m., a man was walking past the Gribble House when he heard groans, unnatural sounds, as he would later describe it. He approached the home to try to figure out where the sounds were coming from. As he walked up the steps to the front door, he noticed that the door was partially opened. He continued to hear that moaning sound and tried to push the door open. He tried a few times and then realized why the door wouldn't open all the way. It was blocked by a body, the body of Maggie Hunter, who was still alive. It was her groans this man had heard. He looked at Maggie in shock as he realized she was in a pool of blood because her skull had been crushed. The man ran to a local store to call for police and an ambulance. Emergency workers arrived to transport Maggie Hunter to the hospital. She was clinging to life, having suffered a grisly attack. Along with her skull having been crushed, she was badly beaten and her throat had been slit. It was a miracle she had survived the initial attack. Police entered the Gribble house to try to find clues as to what happened to Maggie Hunter. When they entered, they found that they were dealing with not only a violent attack on Maggie, but a double murder. When police walked into the home and walked straight down the hallway towards the back door, they saw the body of Carrie Olander. Police would later confirm Carrie had been raped before her throat had been slit and her skull was crushed, just as Maggie's had been. Based on the defensive wounds on her body, police knew Carrie had fought as hard as she could to escape her fate that day. The body of Carrie's mother, Eliza, was found in the back bedroom. Her skull had also been bashed in, but she was found on the floor near her newspaper and eyeglasses, which led authorities to believe that Eliza had been reading and was surprised by her attacker and had no time to react. Unlike Carrie, Eliza had no defensive wounds, and there were no real signs of struggle. Police would later say it seemed oddly peaceful. As you can imagine, the people in this neighborhood, the city of Savannah, they were terrified. There was an axe murder on the loose, and they all wondered, would this person strike again? That fear, along with the fact that reporters were allowed to roam freely throughout the murder site and come and go as they pleased, led to a lot of gossip and false stories reaching the public. When the story was printed in the Savannah Evening Press, a riot broke out in the city of Savannah as mobs went hunting for a murderer. A mob stormed the jail in outrage, making the prisoners fear for their lives. The story the Evening Press published that night noted that the crime was said to have been committed by an African-American man who had been working in the area over the past few days. That news was based on a comment from a neighbor of the Gribble house who said that he had seen a black man running from the scene of the crime. This led to the story making national headlines and the Los Angeles Herald reporting that 150 black men had been rounded up on suspicion and assumption that the assailant was black. Police continued to work the case at the Gribble house, bringing in bloodhounds. A search was made by lamplight and a burned cloth and some bloodstains were found, but the hounds, well, they weren't able to track the scent of a suspect. This led police to offer a $1,000 reward for the arrest of a suspect in what had become known as one of the most diabolical crimes in Savannah history. What the public didn't know at the time, in the days following the murders, when Maggie Hunter was in the hospital fighting for her life, she had identified her killer. Maggie Hunter was taken to Savannah Hospital, where a team of doctors desperately tried to save her life. They opened veins in her arm and infused a quart of salt water solution into her body. They also heavily sedated her. At one point in her delirium, Maggie Hunter cried out that there was a man in the back of the room. She begged doctors and nurses to protect her from this man who wanted to hurt her. Maggie's condition would improve and then worsen. The pastor of Southside Baptist Church, Reverend John Wilder, was known throughout the community as Brother John for his good works. Reverend Wilder had heard of the murders and of Maggie Hunter's condition, and he went to the hospital to sit at her bedside to try to comfort her. He didn't want her to be alone. Reverend Wilder spoke to a reporter from the Savannah Evening Press on December the 13th, days after the attack, and was quoted as saying the following, "I asked her if she recognized me. She looked at me carefully and said yes and called my name. I spoke to her about her soul and prayed with her. I asked her who it was that assaulted her. She replied that it was a white man and called a name. Her estranged husband, J.C. Hunter." The minister notified police and Hunter was arrested after police found bloody clothing stuffed inside his fireplace. But police released Hunter when his coworkers claimed he left work that day only between noon and 12:30. They said he had been with them that afternoon between 2 to 3 p.m., which was the estimated time frame of the murders. This contradicted a neighbor's account. This woman had claimed she had seen J.C. Hunter leaning against an old oak tree in front of the home around the time of the murders. Reverend Wilder continued to keep watch over Maggie Hunter in the hospital. In her delirium, Maggie yelled something about her husband having slapped her. The Reverend reported this to police, and J.C. Hunter was once again arrested. And within hours, Maggie Hunter was dead. When authorities took J.C. Hunter into custody and questioned him, he claimed that his wife told him she would leave him alone if he bought her a sewing machine so she could take in sewing and earn a living. He said he wanted to be free of her, and he was the one who purchased the sewing machine Maggie Hunter had brought to the Gribble boarding house. J.C. Hunter claimed he had taken it to his wife, then visited her on the morning of the murders to see if she was satisfied with it. When police looked into the story, they learned he had lied. Family and friends of Maggie Hunter told police that Maggie had breakfast with her sister, Mrs. Hewlett. She later stopped at three nearby homes, trying to sell some remnants of cloth to make money. Yet another witness claimed he saw Maggie Hunter going toward Perry Street around 1:45 on the afternoon of the murders, and he claimed Maggie Hunter was very drunk. If true, and if the murders happened around 2 p.m., as the police and authorities have always estimated, Maggie Hunter arrived home just after the other two women had been killed, and her fate was sealed the moment she walked in the door of Gribble House. The question that very nervous residents of Savannah kept asking, why were Eliza Gribble, Carrie Olander, and Maggie Hunter murdered? Two major theories emerged. The first theory was that the whole incident had been a robbery gone bad. There had been rumors that Eliza Gribble owned a trunk that held valuable objects. Maybe someone broke in with the intention of stealing what was inside the trunk and ended up killing Eliza and Carrie when the robbery was in progress. Maggie Hunter would have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Based on the police timeline of the murders, it's believed that Eliza Gribble and Carrie Olander were already dead when Maggie Hunter arrived home on the afternoon the murders happened. The second theory was that Maggie Hunter's husband killed her for revenge and that Eliza Gribble and Carrie Olander were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They had seen J.C. Hunter and could identify him, so they had to be killed before he took his revenge on Maggie when she arrived home. A witness had told police that Maggie's husband, J.C., had threatened to kill his wife before. Police also learned that J.C. Hunter, who had worked as a wallpaper hanger, had papered the inside of the Gribble home 6 years before the murder, which would mean he was familiar with the interior. As police would continue to say during their investigation, one part of the case that baffled them, even beyond motive for the murders, was why didn't anyone report hearing something? When police canvassed the neighborhood on the day of the murders, a majority of neighbors told them time and time again they saw nothing and heard nothing out of the ordinary at the time the crime had been committed. The house was near the Citizen and Southern Bank building. The railroad office for the Central of Georgia, with about 175 employees, was also very close to the Gribble House. With the estimate of the murders happening around 2 p.m., police and the media noted that this was the dinner hour for railroad employees. 175 employees inside the railroad and another 450 employees in the bank building and a few more buildings nearby, yet no one heard the sounds of three women being violently attacked with an axe. As the evening press put it, there is a veritable stream of humanity surging through these streets at this hour, and yet so far as can be ascertained, not a human being other than the murderer is known to have heard a sound coming from the house where the bodies were discovered, bathed in blood. Adding to the mystery around the Gribble House murders is Maggie Hunter's prediction of her own death. On December 16th of 1909, the Savannah Morning News reported that Maggie had stated the bloody work would be done by 5 p.m. The paper referenced a witness named John Flatman. Flatman was an insurance salesman who had met with Maggie Hunter at her sister's house early on the day of the murder. He was there to collect a premium on an insurance policy her husband, J.C., had purchased. Maggie Hunter didn't have the money, and Flatman told her if she made payment of at least 60 cents by Saturday, the insurance policy would remain intact. Maggie Hunter told Flatman that she didn't think she would be alive on that day. Mr. Flatman asked her if she planned to kill herself, and she said no. Mr. Flatman also pointed out that Maggie was very nervous when she spoke to him. Flatman's statement to the police convinced them that this wasn't a random act of violence at the Gribble House. J.C. Hunter, Maggie's estranged husband, had been arrested, accused of the Gribble House murders. Months after the murders, on February the 23rd of 1910, Hunter would be indicted by a grand jury. But he wasn't the only man indicted for the triple murders that day. Along with J.C. Hunter, Willie Walls and John Coker were suspects in the case who had been arrested and accused of the crime. And several other men had been suspects. All the men questioned and accused denied any knowledge or involvement in the murders. During the investigation, police learned that Willie Walls had tried to visit Maggie Hunter on the day of the attack. He had been seen walking through the yard outside of the Gribble House a few times and told police he kept trying to see if Maggie was home so he could visit her. Police also learned that Willie Walls had paid Maggie's rent at the Gribble House for an entire month. You see, Willie Walls was believed to be Maggie Hunter's lover. And John Coker, he was arrested based on information provided by a neighbor who claimed he had been around the scene at the time of the crime. The techniques investigators used to try to prove their case against these men were nothing short of bizarre. As mentioned earlier, police and reporters walked through the crime scene, coming and going as they pleased, with no attempts to preserve the scene of the crime. And curious people around the neighborhood would go into the Gribble House where these grisly murders had been committed with no police on the scene. Strangers would just roam freely in and out of the Gribble House. There was no forensic science to help with investigators in the early 20th century, so police relied on the third degree and what was known as the touch test. When J.C. Hunter was arrested the second time, he didn't know that his estranged wife Maggie had died hours later. Neither did Maggie's suspected lover, Willie Walls, who was also brought into the police station and arrested on suspicion of murder. After midnight, police transported J.C. Hunter and Willie Walls to the home of Maggie's sister. The two men were made to walk into a dimly lit room where they saw the corpse of Maggie Hunter. Police had a theory they held close in the early 20th century that murderers would confess when they were made to confront what they had done. And that meant seeing the corpse of their victim, and sometimes even touching the corpse of their victim. J.C. Hunter was brought into the room where his wife was laid out, prepared for her funeral, in her coffin. Hunter, who wasn't aware Maggie had died, seemed shocked when he saw her cold, lifeless body, and he began to sob and showed great signs of distress. Police asked if J.C. wanted to kiss his wife, and he asked when Maggie had died. When police told him about her hospital stay and her death, J.C. once again began sobbing. It was then the police led him away from Maggie's coffin and took him back to his cell at the police station. Next, authorities brought Willie Walls into the room. Walls simply reached out to hold Maggie's lifeless hand and told police she had been a dear friend to him. And as to the other suspects in the case, police had insisted a white man wouldn't have committed the murders. They believed they were looking for a black man. And on December 22nd, they arrested a man named A.M. Baker, who was also known as John Williams. He would later be released and was never put on trial for the murders. And a month later, on January the 25th of 1910, the Sheriff's Department claimed that this time they had arrested the real Gribble House murderer. The man was named Bingham Bryan, and he had worked as the yard man at the Gribble House. Police believed he had killed the victims to steal Gribble's property that was rumored to be in the trunk in her home. Police once again used the third degree to question Bryan, and they did it in an extremely bizarre way. First, they had to purchase their supplies. Authorities purchased 3 wax figures, 3 coffins, and then hired a man to act as a ghost. The wax figures were taken to the Gribble House. All the windows were blocked with blankets to make the house as dark as possible. The wax figures were placed in the same positions in which the bodies had been found, including clothing that was similar to that of the victims. Police even made the wax figures look as though they had the same wounds the victims had by smearing animal blood on them. And then they placed the coffins beside the bodies. That night, the deputy and a jailer took Bingham Bryan to the house where he was shown the scene, and as the deputy held a flashlight, the man hired to act as a ghost shouted to Bryan that the dead women in the house were the last women Bingham Bryan had killed. Brian wasn't nervous, shocked, or out of sorts. He was calm as he walked through the house. In fact, he had no reaction to any of what happened in the Gribble house that day. Eventually, Brian was declared insane and was no longer considered a suspect in the murders. As to Willie Walls and John Coker, who had been indicted for murder, these men never stood trial. The case against Willie Walls was weak and authorities released him. And John Coker, well, police found that the servant who had given testimony saying Coker was seen running from the house on the day of the murder was a cocaine addict and was hoping to gain some type of reward money from the story. Coker was released and was never put on trial for the murders. But J.C. Hunter, he did stand trial. And on August 17th of 1910, Hunter was convicted and sentenced to death by hanging. He appealed his sentence, and by March of 1911, his conviction was upheld by the Georgia Supreme Court, and J.C. Hunter was sentenced to hang on December 22nd of 1911. But once again, something very strange happened in the Gribble House murder case. Reverend Wilder, who had sat by Maggie Hunter's bed as she lay dying and accused her husband of murder, well, that same Reverend Wilder baptized J.C. Hunter the day before he was to be executed. Wilder had become a spiritual advisor to J.C. Hunter. He even worked to have over 300 people sign a petition asking for clemency for J.C. Hunter, claiming Hunter's conviction was based on circumstantial evidence. But the day before Hunter was to hang, no one had heard from the governor, and Hunter asked Reverend Wilder to baptize him to help him prepare for his death. Wilder agreed, and the jail allowed him to use a bathtub in the hospital ward to fill with water to be used in the baptism. Several witnesses joined the Reverend and J.C. Hunter in the ward that day, and witnessed Reverend Wilder ask Hunter if he was guilty of murdering his wife and the women of Gribble House. Hunter replied, "Before my just God, I stand here and tell you that I know no more about the death of those three innocent women than a babe yet unborn. Before God, I am innocent." Wilder baptized Hunter and then turned to him and asked him, "Mr. Hunter, if the governor shall let you die tomorrow, do you feel satisfied to go before God innocent?" Hunter replied, "I do, because I am an innocent man." While Hunter was still standing in the water, the Reverend Wilder shocked him and the witnesses when he proclaimed, "The governor has commuted your sentence." And Wilder was telling the truth. Governor Clifford Walker commuted Hunter's sentence to life in prison. Years later, in March of 1917, J.C. Hunter was serving his life sentence for the murders when a man made a very strange confession. His name was J.B. Garvin. He was at the Mexico border when he learned that a policeman serving in the National Guard there was from Savannah. He approached this policeman and told him that he was responsible for the Gribble House murders. He confessed to the murder of all three women, saying he had committed the crime with a partner. When the officer questioned him and pressed him for any information about the crime scene, Garvin described the interior of the house with great detail. When police looked into the case, they took into consideration that people had come and gone inside the Gribble House following the murders. Any number of people knew the interior of the home, but Garvin did describe items he and his partner in crime had stolen after the women were murdered. But that seemed to have been ignored by police. Garvin was considered insane, unstable, and authorities viewed his confession as a madman spinning tales. He was never arrested. The case took one last dramatic turn on August the 27th of 1923 when J.C. Hunter, who was 77 years old, was pardoned by the governor. J.C. Hunter was set free. In the over 100 years since the Gribble House murders, theories as to who was responsible for the brutal murders of Eliza Gribble, Carrie Olander, and Maggie Hunter, well, they are numerous. Some believe J.C. Hunter really believed his wife had been unfaithful and went to Gribble House on that cold December day to exact his revenge for her betrayal. and Carrie and Eliza fell victims to his rage and revenge. Still others believe this was a random attack by someone hell-bent on killing. Remember, the Gribble House was next to the railroad tracks. Maybe the attacker worked for the railroad, knew the train schedule. Maybe he entered the home and committed the crime as the steam trains were coming into the railroad yard. That could explain how no one heard the desperate and bone-chilling screams women would make as they were being attacked and axed to death. Maybe those sounds were drowned out by the sounds of the train and the eerie whistles blowing that day. Another theory that has never been disproved, and many people believe to this day, was that J.B. Garvin's confession was the truth. That this man who was dismissed by police was the man who walked up the steps of Gribble House and carried out one of the most diabolical and violent attacks in Savannah, Georgia history. The mystery of the Gribble House murders has continued to hold the attention of the city of Savannah and those who visit each year. The Gribble House was demolished in the 1940s, but a warehouse was built on the site, a warehouse that many people believe is haunted. Ghost Adventures filmed at the location in 2012, and many of Savannah's ghost tours include the location where the Gribble House once stood. Maybe the area is haunted, which can be scary to those who believe in a world that extends beyond this life. But nothing seems more haunting than the reality of what happened to three women who were struggling to survive under difficult circumstances. Three women fighting so hard to make their lives better until someone walked into their home, their safe place, and turned their hope into a nightmare. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. If you have theories or thoughts on the Gribble House murders or any of the stories you've heard on the podcast, join our Facebook group. Just search for Southern Mysteries to join in on the conversation. And if you're on Twitter, I'd love to connect with you there. Just follow at Mysteries Pod. And remember to subscribe to Southern Mysteries wherever you listen to your favorite podcast so you will never miss a new episode. Thanks for listening.